Hi, good evening, everyone. We're going to start with Esther Perek Bet, the very last pasuk. So it says the words, "Vayivukash hadavar v'yimatse." Okay, so it's on this sheet, looks like that, or on your, actually that's my sheet. Yours looks like this. Okay, right here. Everyone see it? Okay. So that's what we're going to begin with. All right, so it's the last pasuk in the second perek of Megillat Esther. So it reads like this. V'yevukash, okay, hadavar, v'yimatse. And the matter was examined. The matter of what? That you had two of the chamberlains that were trying to kill Ahasuerus. Okay? So, v'yivukash hadavar v'yimatzei, and the matter was searched out, found to be true, v'yitalu shnehem ala eitz, and these two chamberlains were then hung on a tree, v'yikatev the sefer divrei hayamim lifnei ha-melech, and it was all written out, okay, in the book of Chronicles before the king. Okay? So, what I wanted to do was give a serious look at the Malbim. So, if you're looking at this sheet, looks like that, which is around there. If you're looking at this sheet and you turn it over, you'll get to the Malbim. Okay? Looks like this. All right, so this is an amazing Malbim. Of course, in my book, almost everything the Malbim says is pretty amazing and pretty important. I've been studying the Malbim now for close to 20 years. And word by word, pasuk by pasuk, sefer by sefer. So my chavrusa and myself, we're now up to Parshat Mishpatim. We started with Bereishit, we got to Mishpatim, and we do every single Malbim, every Rashi, and so forth. So I have a tremendous affinity for the Malbim. And sometimes, but not necessarily in this case, I actually am fortunate enough to begin to think like him, and I feel very good about that. So who was the Malbim? So the Malbim lived in 1809 to 1879 in the Ukraine. Okay, so some of us, including myself, until I did a little work, I thought Kiev was maybe Russia, but actually, technically, it's in Ukraine. And that's where he had his Rabbanut. So in the 1809 to 1879 period, during his lifetime, the Maskilim traveled from Western Europe to Eastern Europe, formed Judaism, became a force to reckon with in the Orthodox world. So in some ways, really, the Malbim was the Rabbeinu Shimshon Raphael Hirsch of the Ukraine. Okay? So with that as the opening, let's take a look and see what he says. So we have that pasuk, v'yivukash hadavar v'yimatse, and the matter was searched out, and it was found to be true. Look at this sleight of hand he sort of uses here to explain. He switches two words. Rotze lomar. This means to say, v'yimatse hadavar. In other words, and the matter was found. If you go back again, look how the actual lashon of the pasuk is. It says, v'yivukash hadavar v'yimatse. And the matter was sought out, and it was found to be true. It's not what the Malbim says. He switches the two words. So he has v'yimatse hadavar, and the matter was found. So, in other words, what in fact was found? That's the big question. Okay? So we sort of intimated last week that it had something to do with poison. And that's exactly how the Malbim explains it. It says this. And the object, the the entity of potential death was found. Shenimsa guf hasam. They actually found the poison itself. Shiratsu lahamita, with which they sought to kill Achashverosh. Okay? Shezeh davar rechok hametziut. This itself was something that on so many levels made no sense at all. Okay? Ki vadai histiru oto hasam b'mat monim. Because for sure, the would-be assassins had hidden the poison, right, within containers. Okay? So they had everything planned out. But nonetheless, as the Malbim explains so interestingly, v'yimatzei hadavar, the matter was found. The poison itself was discovered, which was l'malo min hateva. It shouldn't have been. Yes?
Who discovered it?
Ah, that's a good question.
I simply try to ask good questions.
Right, it's a good question. So what we know is that Mordechai overheard that there were these two chamberlains, okay, and we described them last week sort of as Secret Service people, okay? And they were like, you know, they were this third column against Achashverosh. And what happened was is that he tells Esther. Esther tells the king. Okay? And the king, based on what the Malbim is saying, said, well, go look and see if you can find anything. And normally, it wouldn't have been found. But through Hashgacha Pratit, which is going to be the theme we're going to see here, it is found. Okay? Let's see. Now, you see this. So far, we've only had an intimation of the Hashgacha Prati, but now we're going to have it very, very explicit in the words of the Malbim. V'yikatev, okay, and then, in other words, after it was found, it was written about, okay? Now, the Malbim is going to talk about two different kinds of Hashgachot, two different kinds of divine providence that are very manifest in this whole episode. And remember, this episode becomes another fundamental link in the ultimate salvation of Klal Yisrael, which is why the Malbim spends the time on it, and we're spending time on the Malbim. So he says this, and the matter was written about. Haya b'hashgachat Hashem, shelo shilem lo hamelech, scharo tekef. So the very fact that it was recorded, and we're going to see in momentarily, not only was it recorded, but it was recorded before the king, and so forth. So it's recorded, but instead of Achashverosh immediately saying something to Mordechai like, what would you like? You want a roll of gold bullion? I mean, you know, is that something you'd enjoy? Instead of something like that happening, Mordechai initially was not rewarded. Now, we know Achashverosh's modus operandi. We know that he was not a person who, let's put it this way, was very planful. We know that he wasn't far-seeing. I'm going to try not to be political. Okay? So he didn't really plan things out all that well. So you would have thought he would have been his usual jump to it, go to it kind of guy. But he doesn't. He holds himself back. He doesn't give the reward. Instead, Rak Katvu B'Sefer. The only thing that happened right now, even though Mordechai saves his life, it's written down.
Okay. Well,
remember, at this point, he doesn't know who's a Jew, who's not a Jew.
He knows that Mordechai is a Jew. Isn't that obvious?
Well, I don't know. Because remember, the Jews of Shushan were very, very assimilated. To the point? To the point they were drinking out of the...
Yeah, not Mordechai.
You know, not Mordechai. He's the only one. So...
You're telling me there were people
But did he say he was part of the Sanhedrin?
I was just about to say.
Sure.
That. Yeah. So there had to be
sure, other people but how identifiable? Yeah, but you're going to see, amazingly, as we go through tonight, the only person in the whole kingdom, apparently, who does not bow down to Haman is Mordechai.
Right, so the Sanhedrin.
The only one. But that's later. Because at this point, have we yet had Haman come on the scene? No. That's
but
the
Esther
next pasuk.
Esther had to hide that she was Jewish, so there were visible Jews then.
She didn't say she was Jewish. He had no idea she was.
I mean, if you came without a head covering and you know,
right, but there must have been some
thing,
people who
no one
were
would know you're Jewish.
There were Jews, but they acted like everybody else. That's why when the decree comes out, right? And as Rav Soloveitchik points out, he says, yesterday they're all drinking together. Tomorrow they're going to, you know, they get orders, they have to kill everybody. What's going on?
So
you couldn't tell who was who.
So if they all assimilated and didn't do a whole lot, did they still have brises? Did the women still go to mikvahs? Did they still keep the basis?
Sure, but it was done in a very secret way, almost a Murano-like way. But they were not clearly Jewish to the eye.
But working on Shabbos is working on Shabbos. You know that their store is closed.
Not then.
We don't know.
Shabbos is Shabbos. You know that they close it.
I'm not arguing, okay? But...
No, remember, even the Jewish women were working for Vashti,
you know,
at the time.
But,
so they were still working on Shabbos.
In other words, there's a lot going on in the background that bespeaks a lot of problems, a lot of assimilation. Okay, that it's the subtext of the subtext, but which is never talked about. But that's what's going on.
You know, they're Jewish.
Okay.
Okay.
So at any rate, what do we have here is Mordechai does not receive his reward right away, but it wasn't because he was Jewish. It was because really the divine hand. In the hidden way that we only recognize later on in this story, was sort of, in a sense, holding Ahasuerus back from being his usual, self of jumping here, jumping there, jumping everywhere, and says, oh, okay, give the guy a couple quarters. That's not what happened. So instead, Rak, Katvu B'Sefer, it was only written down, L'Zikaron. Ah, but it was remembrance. And look what the Malbim says. Kedei she'amod zot l'Mordechai l'Yeshua l'yom pikuda. So that this would be there, hanging.
Like a seed was planted.
Exactly. So in other words, when it was necessary, okay, it would come to protect Mordechai. And you know what happens. It's not a small thing. What happens? He rides on the king's horse, and he's wearing the king's clothes. And who's taking him through the street? None other than your enemy and mine, right? Haman. So that's the big, gigantic reward, right? Which is the whole idea of v'hafachu, v'hafachu, right? Everything gets turned upside down. All right, so that's the first hashkacha, says the Malbim. Second hashkacha, v'haya b'zeh hashkacha pratit. So now this is really two-part. Shelo nechtav b'sefer divrei hayamim hakoleil. This is very subtle, very subtle. There apparently were two ledgers of chronicles. There was the chronicle of the whole kingdom, and there was a chronicle that the king himself had. They'd write it down, and apparently Ahasuerush could read, or if he couldn't read, someone would read it to him, so he'd fall asleep at night, right? And where was the whole story about Mordechai written down? It was written down in the king's private chronicle. Very interesting. Shehu nimsa tamid biyad hamishneh. The viceroy of the king, who apparently was always with the king, okay, always kept this book. She'az vada haya Haman Mocho Misham. Because if it had been found, okay, so if it had been found otherwise, then what would have happened? then it would have been destroyed because Haman would have gotten it erased. Because the last thing he wanted, once he knew that Mordechai was a Jew, was to have any good things happen to him. Okay? So if it had been public, then it would have been destroyed. But instead it was private. So Rak Nichta B'Sefer Divrei Yamim HaMiyuchad LaMelech. But that's why it was only written in that particular one. So this itself was miraculous. Another level of quiet miracle. Okay? Shelo Hisig Oto Haman. Haman couldn't get to it. And next, last but not least, what was the manner of the writing? Anything that was going into the king's private chronicle was written before the king. So the king knew it was authentic. Couldn't doubt the authenticity because he, you know, it was written before him, and as it was being written, it was being read. Okay? And then the king remembers it later. Because if you remember, why does the king find out about this altogether?
Because he woke up during the night.
He has trouble sleeping. And see, all these little things that seemingly are so unimportant. What do we see? So Vagam Shenektav of Ne'amel Chaynu Befanav, and it was written before him. Now, why is that so significant? Look at the Malbim. I couldn't have said this myself. The Malbim says it. Shem Lo came. If it hadn't been done that way, Hayat Nakel, it would have been very easy. Shahas Sofer, that the Sofer Yizayef could have denied the authenticity of the text. V'yigareya and denigrate it, or v'yigareya bo and say, this never happened. But no, think about it. It's not the public Divrei Hayamim, it's the private Divrei Hayamim. It was written specifically before him, so the king vouched on his own for its authenticity. That's what that final pasuk means when it says, okay, v'yikatev v'sefer Divrei Hayamim lifnei ha-melech. It's a brilliant interpretation of the Malbim. And that ends the second parak. Does anyone have any questions on what we did so far tonight? This is your big chance to ask your bombastic questions, as sometimes people say. No? Okay. Let's get started then with the very first pasuk of the third parak. Now, on these sheets, I did something different than I've been doing so far. I integrated, okay, Peirush, that we're going to be looking at, Makorot, with the actual text itself. So I'm going to ask you, if you don't mind, I'll show you my paper. Go all the way down to our first pasuk, which is right here, which is Esther Perek Gimel Pasuk Aleph. It's about three quarters down the page. It should be Gimel.
Oh, okay.
Everyone see that?
Gimel right there.
Oh,
got it?
Okay.
Everyone got it? All right. That's our very first pasuk. Okay? And the pasuk starts with the words, Achar ha-devarim ha-eile. And it was after these matters.
Didn't we have that in the last parak?
We had it in the last parak. We did. And I said briefly that whenever it says Achar ha-devarim ha-eile, a dramatic change is about to ensue. I may even have used that exact phrase. Okay? I want to prove that to you. Go to the top of the page. And we're going to see, let's see how many altogether. We're going to look in Sefer Bereshit and in Megillat Esther, and there's altogether 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 instances between Sefer Bereshit and Megillat Esther. And there's actually 2 more instances in Sefer Malachim, okay, where it says, Achar ha-devarim ha-eile, and in all instances, it's a dramatic change. However, I wasn't going to bring down the Malachim psukim because they wouldn't be as shagur bapiv. You wouldn't recognize it immediately, but this you'll recognize. Let's look at the first one. First one is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises Avram, he's not even yet Avraham, that he's going to protect him and he's going to have great reward. Okay, so it says, Achar hadavarim ha'ele, okay, haya davar Hashem el Avram, after these things Hashem spoke to Avram, b'machazeh, in a vision, saying, don't be afraid, Avram, don't be afraid, anochi magen lecha, I will protect you, actually magen lach, I will protect you, and scharcha harbe ma'od, and your reward will be very great. So the first big dramatic idea, and the first time it's used is achar hadavarim ha'ele, is Hashem's protection and Hashem's reward to Avraham. In this case, Avram. The next one you all know already. Akedat Yitzchak. Asa vayehi achar hadavarim ha'ele. Okay? So the first was a dramatic change. This is a transformative, dramatic change. This changes Jewish history for all time. Because I don't know about you, I don't think I could count the number of tefillot, let's say on Rosh Hashanah, where Akedat Yitzchak is mentioned. Okay, let alone the fact that we read it then, right? So it's one of the biggest, you know, transformative events in all of Jewish history. Next, Vahi Achar Adivar Me'ele V'tisa Eshet Adonav Et Eneha. This is your friendly Eshet Potifar, who tried to seduce Yosef, and Yosef refused. But again, how's that event discussed, introduced? By he achar dvarim ha'ele, and it was after these things. Okay? Now, why is that so much of a transformation as well? Because what happens to Yosef?
He's going into jail.
He goes into jail. And who does he meet up with in the jail? The Sarha Mashkin. And right, the Sahara Ophim. Right? Now, that leads us to the next Pasuk in Bereishit. Vayi achar hadivar me'ele, chatu mashke, right? Mashke melech Mitzrayim, v'ha'ofe. So the Sahara Mashkim and the Sahara Ophim, they both somehow in various ways sinned to Paro. They get thrown into jail. And who do they meet with? Yosef. And later on, it's the Sar HaMashkim who says to Paro, I didn't tell you, Paro, don't be upset with me, but there is this genius who can interpret your dreams. But that's not how he says it. He says all these pejoratives about him, if you remember, right? All these terrible pejoratives, including Ivri, which was a very big pejorative within the Egyptian mind. But at any rate, all those psukim, okay, those four psukim, all have the idea of big dramatic change and vayi achar dvarim ha'ele. Okay, you ready?
How come we don't use that term during Yetzias Mitzrayim or Matan Torah?
Why don't we use that term?
It was the most dramatic episode.
Good point. Well,
because God wanted it that way.
It's a creative way to ask the question. The usual question in Parshanut is, why does it say X? Okay.
But and, you were saying we say when there's a dramatic turn.
Correct.
So those two, like we always say, how Yetzias Mitzrayim was the most.
Yeah.
You know. Whatever.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
I didn't disagree. It actually breaks a paradigm. Okay, because like I said, you're asking in a way that is authentic and it's good and it's powerful, but I don't have an answer at all because we usually, like I said, we usually go from. It says X, why doesn't it say Y?
Okay, so
you're
why
saying
does it,
it doesn't
so
say,
why does it X, say X,
why not? Okay.
Matan Torah was out of the ordinary and Hashem.
Right.
All this was out from, you know, also.
No, all of these things were out of the ordinary, but Matan Torah, what was right. Greater than Matan Torah?
And Yetzias Mitzrayim and Kriyat Yamsuf. It's. You know, I don't have an answer for you, but I need to stress, because it's it's not just intellectual honesty, but it's also on the level of healthy relationship. The fact that I don't have an answer doesn't mean it wasn't a good question. I need you to hear that. That's very important. Okay? So I have to think about it. I don't know if anyone answers that question, but I have to think about it.
You have homework to do. It's not nice.
Okay. All right. Then, in Megillat Esther, we already saw the instance that appears in our perek, Achar Devar Me'ela, and we get into the wonderful world of, Lahavdil of Haman. But even before that, as one of you pointed out, didn't we see that already? Yes, we saw it already. It was the very first pasuk of the last perek. It also started with Achar HaDevarim HaEla. Right? You guys got that? So it's interesting. You have two prakim in a row that start the same way. So Achar HaDevarim HaEla, and this is about, remember, Achashverosh is no longer quite as angry, and he decides, what am I going to do? I really do need a nice queen, and so on and so forth.
So it's kind of like a transition phrase. It's telling you, okay, something's coming.
Something dramatic. Okay, those of you who remember West Side Story, something's coming. I don't know what it is, but it's going to be.
You would hear, that's
what it is. Tremendous drama. If this was a symphony, okay, it's sort of like reminds me of like the opening bars of a Beethoven symphony. So you say, bum, 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 and it starts. That's what Achar Devarim HaEla is. That's what it says to me. At any rate, let's take a look. We have Ach. Now we're going to go down to Esther Paragimel Pasuk Aleph. This is the Hakdama to discovering who, and in this instance, really what Haman was. So let's read it. Achar HaDevarim HaEla, after these things, let's get it correct. Gidal HaMelech Achashverosh. The king Achashverosh raised up Haman ben Hamadatta Ha'agagi, right? So he's the son of Hamadatta, who was an Agagite, okay? An Agadite. V'yina Sehu, and he rose him up, raised him up. V'yasem et Kiso, Me'al kol ha'sarim, and he placed his throne above all of the princes, asher ito. Okay. Now, the expression Haman, okay, ben Hamadatta ha'agagi, you'll notice this is the first time. It dropped down to the next full pasuk. It's the second time. Drop down to the last pasuk of this page. It's the third time. And then, if you turn the page over, you'll see it's a fourth time. It's not once or twice, but four times his lineage, his genealogy is spelled out.
Is there any other place with something like that?
Four times for the lineage? Not of which I am aware. Okay. Now, does that mean that it couldn't be another place and I just don't know? For sure. But this is highly unusual. And this raises the question, and this is the classic way, is that it says X and then we ask why. Okay? And that's what we have. Four times. So that's going to lead us to an exploration of Haman ben Hamadatta HaGagi. Now, we did this, if you recall, we talked a lot about Achashverosh and who he really was. We talked about Esther. We talked about Mordechai. So the next person to come on the stage, of course, is Haman. And now, we had two prakim. And I always am amazed how quiet it is in shul until the third parak. Okay, and all of a sudden, do you remember the Flintstones? Bam Bam?
Yeah.
Everyone's Bam Bam, It's pretty amazing, but not for the good reasons, obviously. So let's see. Let's see, who was this person? All right? So we know that by no means was he a particularly good individual. In fact, he was the worst of the worst. Let's turn over the page and look at our sources. The first source we're going to look at is the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. Now, Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer is one of those works where there's a great deal of argument among scholars. When is it from? That it's a classic Jewish work, everybody agrees. Is it really, really ancient? There's no consensus on that. What's the quote-unquote yeshiva view? Yes, it's very old. And it goes all the way back maybe to the second century. Okay. Other opinions are that it could be very recent. It could be recent in terms of Jewish world. It could be 10th, 11th, 12th century, which for us is recent, right, being how long we've been here. But at any rate, it's a very important work. Let's see what he said. So Rabbi Pinchas Omer, Rabbi Pinchas said, Safa HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Safa means to look into the future. HaKadosh Baruch Hu looked into the future. And what did he see? Sha'atid, in the future, La'amod Me'agag, in the future, there would arise from Agag, who was the king of who? Amalek, right? Okay, who Shaul, this is all very important, right? In this comes in Shmuel, right? Sefer Shmuel, Shaul did not kill. He spared him. Who eventually killed Agag? Shmuel. Because there's a mitzvah to wipe out Amalek. Okay? All right? Timcha et Zecher Amalek. We have, that's the mitzvah. Shaul refrained. Okay? Now, what happened? What's the medrash behind what happens when Shaul refrained from killing Agag that one night? So after all, Agag was a king. Shaul said, a king needs to have someone taking care of him. He's still a king, even if he is from Malek. So Chazal tell us that that night, he was given a shifcha, a slave girl, to take care of Agag's needs. And apparently they became very friendly. And as a result, Agag fathered a child through this maidservant, who eventually goes on ultimately to be the forebearer of who? Haman. Your enemy and mine, Haman. Okay, that's the story behind the story. Okay.
I think I heard once that they said that maybe Hitler was from that Shebek or that family.
So Rav Soloveitchik cites his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who cited his grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the brilliant Rav Chaim. Okay? And Rav Chaim's shita was that anyone who is of the Sone Yisrael falls under the category of Amalek. Anyone. And for obvious reasons, I'm not, you know, since this is public, I'm not going to start naming names. I could say the Nazis, for sure. But in terms of the contemporary scene, you know, I'm limited in what I can and cannot say, but I think you can use your imaginations. Okay? So that certainly fits in with what you said. Okay? See, the thing is this, is that there's no tribe. There's no, all the tribes except for us. All the tribes except for us were completely wiped out in terms of their genetic identity by Sancheriv. Okay, around the time of the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, because he transplanted everybody here, there, and everywhere. So the genetic purity of all these groups was completely destroyed. So there is no genetic Amalek in our day and age. There's no genetic Kenanim. Okay? And all right, going forward, just think of really what the ramifications of all that really happened to be. So anyway, Hashem knew that in the future there'd be someone evil who'd come from Agag. Okay, and he'd be an Ish Tsar Vayayev. Sound familiar? Okay, that's, of course, Haman. And he would be terribly so to our people, to the Jews. Ve'ezeh, right? Ve'ezeh, ze haman harasha. That's the ultimate offspring of Agag. Okay. Yes. Shenamar ki haman ben hamadata ha'agagi sorer kol yehudim. Now you ready? This is the, what I call. You all saw The Lion King or heard The Lion King at some point in your life. I call this the circle of theological life, because the next part of Pirkei D'Rabbi Eliezer says, yeah, you're right. From Agag came Haman. Shaul should have taken Agag out immediately, and then there would never would have eventually have been a Haman.
Then there wouldn't have been a Purim.
Okay. What? And then what?
Then there wouldn't be a Purim. It would have been.
That, you know, think about it. From what tribe, and you may remember this because we did this, from what tribe did Mordechai come?
Yehuda.
What?
Yehuda.
No.
Binyamin.
Oh,
right.
So, what tribe was Shaul from? Binyamin. Shaul failed to take out Agag.
So it's more.
But who rises up eventually to take out Agag's ultimate offspring? Haman. And that's what... Mordechai. I didn't make it up. Look what it says. Umezera Shaul... Goel. And who redeemed us ultimately from Agag's offspring? Okay? Venokem Lihudim Miyad Haman. Who was it? Ve'eze?
Mordechai.
Ze Mordechai. Shenamar Ish Yehudi Haya. So I call this the great circle of theological life. Okay? All right, let's continue. Any questions so far?
I mean, I don't want to say, saying that, yeah, they say, you know, sometimes you punish the kids for what the parents did. This is just the opposite. You're rewarding that generation for what the parents did do.
Because
not
changed. Mordechai was not like Shaul.
Right.
And the... Because, look, there were people among the Romans whose grandchildren, right, the same ones who destroyed the Beit HaMikdash, their grandchildren learned Torah and taught Torah. Okay? So, let's go weiter. So now we have the expression, V'yasem et kiso, and he placed his throne. Now, very interesting. How many of you didn't mean that you actually saw it, and none of us sitting in this room saw it when it came out, but Charlie Chaplin had a movie that was a talk, yeah, it was an early talkie. It was called The Great Dictator. Remember that movie?
I saw it.
Okay. And it was the Saturday Night Live of its time. It showed Hitler, Yamak Shamo, and Mussolini. And each of them was sitting face to face. And they happened to be sitting in barber chairs. Now, being that you guys don't go to barbers, you may not know that a barber chair can be raised or lowered.
Mm-hmm. A beauty so, parlor also can.
Well, being that I've never been to a beauty parlor, except with my mom when I was really little and I don't remember it, I don't know. But anyway, barber chairs can be raised and lowered. Now, here's what happens in that movie. It's one of the greatest scenes I ever saw in my life. It shows, first of all, Hitler, Yamak Shamo, and Mussolini are facing each other. And then, sort of, by the by, Hitler just moves the lever a little bit. He goes up. Mussolini sees that he's not on the same level. He goes up. And then they stop talking, and it becomes a race to the top. Which, of course, given the two people we're talking about, was really a race to the bottom. At any rate, it becomes like, they're going higher and higher and higher. Now with that, read what it says here. Vayasem et kiso, asa lo bima. He made himself a platform. Lamala mbimato, higher than his regular platform. Visama rosh, and therefore his head was higher, me'al kol ha'sarim asher ito. So this is when it says Yasem et Kisa, to be taken literally. Think again, the great dictator, higher and higher and higher and higher. All right? So that brings us now to the second pasuk, okay, which we'll at least we'll start, because I know that we do have to leave in 5 minutes, but let's start it. Esther Paragimel, pasuk bet, okay? V'chol avdei ha-melech, and all of the servants of the king, asher b'shar ha-melech, that were in the gate of the king. Now, notice the key word. What's the key word, guys? It's the very first word. If you're going to circle anything, circle that first word. V'chol, everybody. Okay? It's totally inclusive. So everybody who was in the king's courtyard, Jew, non-Jew, whatever. Korim umishtachavim. Now, does that sound at all familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Aleinu. Fascinating.
And on Yom Kippur, we've seen that a few hundred times.
Like Ahasuerus, who's an egomaniac, who's trusting or whatever, why would he allow them to bow down to someone else? Wouldn't he want that respect for himself?
Oh, very good. So it's the old story of the hyper unhealthy boss. So and so, when you look good, I look good. When you look bad, I fire you. Okay, this is the boss that you want to stay away from. So that's any time someone showed honor and respect to Haman, Ahasuerus was getting more spotlight. Because, like, aren't I a genius? I chose him. He's amazing. Isn't he terrific?
Wasn't he afraid that Haman was going to overthrow him?
Ah, so very good. Very smart. Very smart. Because if you think when he says to Haman, when he's begging for his life on the bed where Esther is lying, that the thing he was really worried about was that while he's in the courtyard, suddenly he's going to actually force Esther into a very compromised position. If you think that's what really is being said, no. He saw that as a challenge against his authority, and his greatest fears were now being realized that Haman did want to take over. That's what's happening there. Very interesting. And Rav Foreman in his book makes a very big point of this. The book we mentioned before, Esther the Queen, you didn't know, or whatever the exact title is, you never knew, I think it is. So anyway, so everybody is bowing and prostrating themselves to Haman, Anachnu Korim Mishtachavim, right? Ki kein tziva lo ha-melech, because the king said so. He commanded. However, Mordechai lo yikra v'lo yishtachaveh. And Mordechai did not bend down and he did not prostrate himself to Haman. The question is, what's going on? And that we're going to read right now. This will be the last thing we do tonight.
So he's disobeying the king, not just disobeying Haman.
Okay, very good. So the interesting thing is, and this is how the Medrash is going to take it, he was disobeying the king with a small k, while he was obeying the king with a big k. Let's look inside and you'll see how good your question was. Achar ha-divarim ha-eila, right? Gidal ha-melech ha-chashverosh at Haman ben ha-madlata ha-gagi, right? V'yina ha-seyu. Okay, that we already saw. V'tziva ha-melech, and the king commanded, shiyu korim u'mishtachavim lo, everybody would bend and they would go flat before him. Now here, I'm so glad Naomi is here because it's a medrash. Okay? Meh asa Haman. What had Haman really done? You ready? Asa lo, he made for himself tselem merukam. An embroidered idol, al bigadav, the alibo. It was over his heart. So obviously, when you bend down, who you're bending down to, not just
idol.
Haman, but
the idol,
right? Like, v'chol mi shehaya mishtachaveh l'Haman, haya mishtachaveh l'avodat kochavim. And everybody that would bow down to Haman was really simultaneously bowing down to the idol. So that, under no account, would Mordechai do.